This is Jazz Talk, presented by Melbourne International Jazz Festival. We would like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the land and pay respects to their elders past, present and future, as well to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people in the wider Melbourne community and beyond. We are honoured to contribute to over 60,000 years of music making, knowledge sharing and storytelling that has taken place on this land. I'm Chelsea Wilson, Artistic Associate of Melbourne International Jazz Festival Congress. This special conversation, A Salute to Alan Brown, was recorded in the Salon at Melbourne Recital Centre as part of Jazz Congress 2021. Alan Brown was an influential drummer, composer, poet and mentor. First known for his work as founding member and drummer of the Red Onion Jazz Band, Alan toured internationally, performing at events such as the Polish and Hungarian International Jazz Festivals. A prolific recording artist, Alan won 4 Jazz Bell Awards and 3 ARIA Awards, was inducted into the Jazz Bell Hall of Fame, and was a recipient of the Don Banks Award. Across his 5-decade career, he worked with countless artists including Andrea Keller, Paul Grabowski, AIDS Munsborough, Herb Ellis, Milt Jackson, Barney Kessel, Mal Waldron, Irby Green, Johnny Griffin, and many more. Not only an influential musician, he was an advocate for the jazz scene. He served as chair of the Melbourne Jazz Co-op, was the patron of Stonington Jazz Festival, and spent 3 years on the music board of the Australia Council. To others, Alan was a mentor, championing the next generation of jazz musicians, including Sam Anning and Shannon Barnett. In this special panel conversation, hear from Alan's collaborators, friends and family on his musical life and incredible contribution to the sector, reminding us how we can all learn something from his legacy. Speakers include ARIA-winning composer and pianist Paul Grabowski, artist and festival director Eugene Ball, pianist Margie Lou Dyer, and Melbourne Jazz Festival artistic director Michael Tortoni. This session was facilitated by bass player, composer and educator Tamara Murphy. This is A Salute to Alan Brown, recorded at Melbourne International Jazz Festival Congress.
Welcome everyone. Considering that the Melbourne International Jazz Festival is a largely Australian event this year, it seemed like the perfect time to pay homage to Australian jazz legend Alan Brown. I'm sure many of you here today already know all about Alan and his incredible career and legacy, but just in case some of you are unaware, I thought a nice way to begin today's conversation would be to give a little overview. Let's face it, it would be impossible to cover everything and find time for others to speak as well. One of Alan's earliest musical exponents was the Red Onion Jazz Band, formed in around 1960. They had local and international success, releasing albums from 1963 through to 1992, with a little break in there. In 1967, they did a major European tour over 10 months, which if any of you have done touring, you know is massive. And there's some remarkable footage of them on different TV programs around this time, which are a must-see if you haven't checked them out before. Alan has played with just about everyone, backing many international touring artists and playing with some of our local jazz megastars, if there can be such a thing. However, I dare say most musicians in Australia now are more aware of Alan's more recent work with his own quintet, the Alan Brown Quintet, and with his many collaborative groups where, whether he did this consciously or not, I'm unsure, he mentored many younger artists. Artists such as Eugene Ball, Chris Tanner, Shannon Barnett, Julian Wilson, Mark Hannaford, Sam Anning, Andrea Keller, and even myself. I feel that I can't exclude poetry from this brief overture. A great appreciator of the written word, Alan used it as inspiration for his music. He wrote it, and he also included poetry with his wonderfully gravelly tones in his own performances and recordings. Everyone up here, though, with me, has long connections with Alan. All of those go much farther back than mine. So I'm very, very happy to pass this conversation on to them so they can give a much deeper insight than me into their connections and experiences. So let me introduce the people with whom I'm sharing this stage today. On my right, we have Eugene Ball. Please make him welcome. Paul Grabowski. Margie Lou Dyer. Michael Tortoni. And I should say my name's Tamara Murphy as well. So I'm not really sure where to start. I thought we'd just basically have a bit of a beginning, I guess, of some of our first experiences with Al, or I don't know if there's anyone has any burning stories they wanted to...
I've got a question for Paul. I just wanted to know about your first meeting of Al, because I'm not aware of that history. So I came back from... I've been living in Germany for since the beginning of... Well, it's actually not the beginning of 1980, but I've been living in Europe since early 1980, and I've been living in Germany since late 80, beginning of 81. And I'd come back to Melbourne for the summer of 82, 83, and I got offered a gig by Martin Jackson at the inaugural Melbourne Jazz Co-op concert, the very first one, which was held at the Glasshouse Theatre at RMIT. And I opted to do a piano trio. And the one person I knew I wanted to play with was Gary Costello, because Gary and I had known each other and played a lot together before I'd left for Europe. So I met Gary probably in 77, maybe. And we struck up a very close friendship. When I got back and wanted to make this trio, Gary immediately recommended Alan. And meanwhile, so had a couple of other people. I seem to remember that I'd had a conversation with Ken Schroeder around that time, and he'd also mentioned Alan. So I had never met Alan before that, and I didn't really know much about him, in fact, because, you know, his history and mine hadn't really connected, mainly because when he was sort of emerging as a really important figure in what we would now describe more or less as modern jazz, during that period I was living away, so I wasn't aware of it. But he was like playing with Vince by then and you know, Anarji and doing all these other projects. So I called a rehearsal at my mother's house in Shirley Avenue, Glen Waverley, and there was Alan. And it was kind of love at first sight, really. I mean, you know, I just loved him. I loved how he played, but I loved the man, you know. And then when I came back permanently at the end of 85, we made that trio my sort of unit and played together for many, many years after that, made a few recordings. And, yeah, I look back on those years extremely fondly.
Terrific.
That's how it all started.
As we go along too, feel free to ask questions if anyone has any questions as we go as well.
Well, I remember a lot of the rehearsals took place in that room at your home on that piano.
Yes, on that that piano. And we bought the house because of that room, because there was space for the kit. Yeah. All the kits, actually. And the piano, which was part of my father's estate, which is a treasured instrument, that G3, and you're well acquainted with it, Paul. Beautiful about it.
I can do things on that piano that I don't think I've ever been able to do on any other instrument. I don't know why.
No.
But it has sort of some sort of magical properties.
It is. It's exceptionally beautiful, and I love it. It's my best friend. And of course, that room at McKinley Avenue. Hundreds of hours of rehearsals with you and Vince, and Eugene and Red Onions. And it was where Alan turned every single day of his life to practice. Mm. It was 45 minutes. It was disciplined. It was with headphones and Miles playing. And he never, even with oxygen, when he was like a dog on a lead with the oxygen machine going, he went to that kit. And it was very... There was a time when, just before his transplant, where he was too ill and the drums were silent, and it really distressed me, because after 30 years together, I'd never heard them still. But the transplant, of course, he was straight back on the kit 10 days out of the Alfred, back on that kit. And he was an autodidact. He was proud of the fact that he had taught himself to play the drums, possibly at Halebury in the pipe band. He'd learnt that beautiful snare work.
Yeah.
And then, of course, just listening to his first favourite man, Baby Dodds. Mm. And then growing through that. However, his grip was wrong. Mm. And so when he gave up drinking, he decided he'd have to learn to play appropriately, and he went to Graham Morgan, who showed him the appropriate grip. And to unlearn a bad habit is so hard, and it took a very long time. And he'd say, sometimes I'll revert to the old grip on the gig because I'm too scared. And then without that subconscious learning that comes from repetitive practice will suddenly come out when you don't expect it, and then there's a change. Mm. And I remember him saying it was just magic that he had this new grip that made facilitated your playing, because he was working too hard the other way. Mm. However, the early recordings of The Onions, I just think his playing is exceptional and exciting and wonderful, and with all that intrinsic passion that is part of the music of New Orleans and later. Mm. And he always said, in Tony Williams, in all the great drummers who are going to escape me, I hear Baby Dodds. And there's only a stylistic difference, but the quintessential passion and use of the triplet crotchets and quavers, etc., that he adored, and the accents continue as a lineage, as we all know, mm. in a different way. So, yes, that room is important and it's still there, and I'd love to have house concerts there. And I'd love you to be part of it, and Eugene, of course.
Yeah.
Sure. Because it is a gorgeous room, and I think it has a spirituality mm. that, without being ridiculously superstitious, there is a spiritual element in that room. Mm. And I feel it when I walk in there. So, yes, I think we should have it sometime.
I love that idea of practicing, you know, that Al was just so committed to practicing, you know, still right up until the end. That there's something beside the kind of practicality of, like, you know, having to get through the next gig. But it takes on, you know, practice takes on something much more meaningful when you're, you know, when you've been doing it for so long that it becomes just a fundamental part of your kind of daily well-being. And I remember Gary speaking about that as well, playing the bass. Practicing the bass was, you know, not a step towards being better as a musician so much as just a daily mental health routine, which I love that idea.
I remember Alan telling a story, and to know Alan was to hear many stories, but one of the beautiful stories was how he made the transition from being the leader of arguably one of the most rigorously, in fact, I would say radically, classical New Orleans ensembles to a completely modern perspective on the music. And it was brought about partially through that very long European tour that they did, where they were at the Warsaw Jazz Jamboree in 1967, maybe. And on the bill was the Charles Lloyd Quartet with Jack DeJohnette, Cecil McBee and Keith Jarrett.
That's right.
And Alan had an epiphany watching that band. He suddenly realised that the continuum of the music, in fact, had not ceased in 1930, which a view which he had quite seriously and rigorously held, you know, for reasons that made sense in and of themselves. But he realised that there was this actual continuum, that what they were doing in that band was essentially, in principle and in its poetic, the same thing.
And in spirit and in energy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, his great, one of his great contributions to our music, and particularly the music of this place, Melbourne, has been his ability to join those extraordinarily important dots. Because, you know, very often the history of jazz is about traditionalists versus modernists, which is the most insanely irrelevant kind of binary that you can possibly propose in a music which is in and of itself supposedly about freedom. So how you can have freedom on the one hand but restrictions on the other, determined by style, never quite rhymed in my head.
And having a, you know, having a role model from a very young age whose attitude towards genres was not to disregard the idea of particular styles or genres, but to traverse them all equally artistically, and to kind of let them bleed into each other, and ultimately to just approach playing any music the way you play, regardless of what it's supposed to be, and to have that as a for me, as a very young musician, have a role model with that ideology, was absolutely everything. It meant that for me going forward, there was never a question about being a traditionalist or a modernist. It was always going to be, embrace everything. Yeah.
Do you think that sort of attitude that Al had, exactly the thing you're talking about, because Melbourne's such a small town and he's such a pivotal part of our scene, do you think that's really affected the Melbourne sound in that sort of way?
I absolutely do.
Mm. Yeah.
I think it affected the art orchestra, in what I was thinking about the art orchestra, as being something which was sort of genre-busting. The whole idea of cross-cultural collaboration, which I've been very involved with for decades now, essentially has its roots in that thinking too. I mean, I can't think of a more important and more influential single musician in my experience in Melbourne than Alan.
Mm. Mm. And, of course, he called Melbourne the Florence of the South.
As do I, too. I always refer to it, with his permission, as the Florence of the South. And that it will all work out in the end.
Absolutely. And I'm sure Michael would appreciate that Alan would see this audience as so appropriate. He'd say, well, we've just spent 6 months working on a project and we had 10 people at Bennett's. And that's what he expected. Oh. And so he'd be so happy. He'd be so happy to see.
Maggie, that's what I expected too. But, and I was very happy too. Because, for 20 years I lived above that club.
Yes.
And Monday nights were always special for me. It was always full of music, poetry, intrigue and espionage, according to Alan. But it was an incredible experience. But, Alan really, for the club, was very influential, not only for me, but also, and the musicians, but the staff. I mean, he brought a certain culture into the club, being there every week, talking to Megan and Jeremy and everybody involved with the club. And his sentiment, his approach, his intellect, really seeped into the walls of the club. I mean, it was, he affected the culture so much. In many ways, like Paul, helped me articulate what Bennett's Lane was about. Mm. So, he was an incredible influence.
Especially his Christmas Eve suppers.
Is it Christmas?
They were very sophisticated, and it'd be something Eugene would love.
Oh.
He would have had. I was always charged with getting them, the provisions for those nights, which was the worst bread at the supermarket, and 2 bottles of tomato sauce, and paper plates. and it would be beautifully inscribed with lots of nice tomato sauce, and people ate them. I actually did. He never came home with any bread or sauce.
I remember when his quintet, we were playing up at Threadbow, and I think we didn't have a night off, but Jeff Hughes and I cooked up, you know, a lavish roast, like just, you know, we're both fairly handy in the kitchen. Everything was all, the table was set, and Al kind of politely picked at a couple of things and then, you know, promptly went to bed with a large plate of Vegemite toast. Anyway.
That'll all work out, mate.
Yeah, it'll all work out. Michael, how did it come about that Al, you know, had the Monday night residency?
Yeah, I wanted to ask that.
I was aware of Alan Brown a long time before Bennett Slane. When I was at college at the VCA, and before I went to the VCA, I was in a band called Taste, and I happened to be playing in that band with a drummer called Virgil Donati. And he was into all sorts of, you know, jazz rock and jazz. And in fact, I think he started jamming at the end of Taste's period with Gary Costello.
And me.
And you,
yeah.
Yes. I thought you were involved.
Yep.
Because I was aware of the three of you as individuals.
Yeah.
And so he introduced me to that whole world, which I was, you know, totally fascinated with. And I guess when I was thinking about opening Bennett's Lane, I was thinking of your trio as really a statement of what the Bennett's Lane was about. Mm. And, you know, I can't actually remember approaching Alan to play the club, but it just happened. It was just there.
It was just
like
there.
It was always there. And it was meant to be there. And he, you know, it was... And I'd never, try to direct what I wanted from him. It was just there and it was his. And I don't remember how it happened, but it happened, and I was happy that it was that way.
Because he didn't have a regular night at the Limerick or anything, did he? Not that I can remember.
Okay. No. There are lots of gigs, goodness, and venues.
Oh, yeah.
That went on and on, like the Black Prince in North Melbourne. That was regular for a while, but which one was that? That might have been the Red Onions.
Oh, yeah, the Black Prince, I remember.
Look, so many.
Yeah.
Goodness, all the venues that have had jazz in Melbourne.
Yeah.
Where are they? What are they?
The Commune.
Yes, the Commune.
Commune, that's...
Mietta's. Mm. Wasn't that exceptional? That was exceptionally beautiful.
That was amazing.
That was the same cultural understanding that Michael provides through Bennett's, etc.
That was a
that Mietta had. And Alan loved all of that.
Yeah.
Because it's very important to have that support.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because jazz musicians are not in it for the money. I mean, it's
really
obvious. No.
Yeah. That's it. I'm out.
I'm really upset by that.
I know.
It's come as a resounding shock after all these years. Is that why I have no money? Do you mean it's because of the jazz?
Well, look, you've just got to change your style.
God. So too late for that.
Yes, and also it struck me because Al and I used to talk a lot in the car or reading or whenever and discussing recordings and takes and stuff. And he loved my father's work, especially with Len and Bob Bernard when they were very,
Walker,
very young. Yes, yeah. Warwick. Yeah. And Alan said, what I adore about this Elfrey Street Stompers, which was an amateur recording, is the total understanding of the genre and the divine passion invested in it. And I often quoted to Al, which he knew, that my father said, as we all take this attitude, that you must play as if it's your last chance to ever play again. And frankly, the last 18 months has really made that crystal clear. that chance to play needs to be as intense as if it's your last one.
Mm.
And heaven help you if you get too jaded that there's no fire in the belly, because you've got to have that edge to play this music, whatever genre.
Yeah.
Mm. To ecstasy, yeah.
Where did that come from?
Well, it was in the Wasp. Now, does it come from a particular...
From Aristophanes.
Yes. But he incorporated that in his Buzzing Wasp.
Yeah.
So I don't know whether he wrote that, did he write that in, or was it already in the...
I just thought it captured that.
He always used to say it.
Mm. He had it painted on his bass drum.
Yeah. Well, that is part of the Wasp lyric.
Mm.
The buzzing and the those who going to go for it. So, yes.
Isn't it James Joyce or something like that?
Yes.
That's what I thought.
So many discussions.
Sorry.
No definitive answer. Which work of Joyce is it? Ulysses.
In my boot, but it's in McKinley Avenue.
I've always got a copy of it lying around somewhere too. I'll try and remember which.
Just in case I might understand it one day.
Yeah.
Listen to Frank Delaney's podcast.
Just getting back to the club for a sec. If I think about, it's probably been the same for you with Al as well. But the number of projects, the number of albums that we, you know, didn't rehearse at all except for, you know, half an hour before the gig at the club, and there would be 10 people in the room. So it was very much a workshop environment. And I think, you know, well, I shudder to think of what the reality might have been like if that opportunity was not there for all of those albums that we made with the quintet, things that I did with him as a trio as well. You know, they really all took shape in that forum. You know, without the kind of the structure of a gig, it would have been incredibly difficult to pull everybody together to rehearse. And, you know, so for that alone, I thank you. But, it was an incredible environment to workshop and develop material. And there's now a large catalogue that's come out of that.
Yeah, and partly the club, you know, in my mind, when I was thinking of the club, was designed to do that. I didn't know how it would work financially, but who cares? You know, that was, you know, I was purely instinctive and in terms of how I structured, you know, or the infrastructure of the club. I didn't really think about the financial outcome until it happened. Fortunately, it kind of all fell into place by chance, probably. But it was meant to be a space to create and develop new work and experiment.
Did you workshop? Is it 6x3? Is that's the one with Gary and Al, isn't it? Or that's the one I remember.
Yeah, that's strongly. The first album. We made that, and then we made When Words Fail, and
that's
we
right.
made the album with Shelley Scarn.
Angel.
Called Angel. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
So, look, the heavy lifting musically with that band happened in rehearsal. We did a lot of rehearsing.
Wow.
And the rehearsals were full-on intensity.
Yep.
Like, we played rehearsals as if they were gigs.
Yeah.
And that's hard to do, isn't it?
It is. And it meant that, you know, when we were at our peak, when we did go to a gig and play, it was like...
On.
It was on.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, and I remember a couple of nights where we just couldn't... You know, the music felt like it was literally levitating.
Nice.
It was like... The music was like playing itself.
Yeah.
We were just kind of... making it happen, but the music seemed to have taken over the process.
And that's what you strive for playing music.
It doesn't happen very often, actually, in a lifetime, but when you've had that experience, that shared energy where the egos are completely gone
Absolutely.
And there's just music being made,
And it is a shared experience.
No single person is responsible for it.
Mm. Yeah, that experience where the music's playing itself, the band's at that level, is just...
Well, we got there, you know, a few times, I reckon.
Yeah.
And you can kind of hear it. You can hear elements of it on the recordings. I mean, there's some beautiful things in those recordings, no doubt. But I've, you know, there's some live stuff. There's actually a bunch of unreleased recordings that we did at Eaton's. And
with that trio?
Yeah.
Cool.
And I've got, you know, like video stuff of us playing various places too. But, you know, I mean, I feel quite emotional even thinking about it. It's one of those things that you can have a lifetime in music. And these constellations of particular individuals, they come and go.
Yep.
But when it happens, it's unforgettable.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. Special.
You know, and you've joined on a level with other people.
Yes.
You've shared something that you can't actually really describe in words, but you know we did that.
It's astral travel.
Mm. Yeah, and it's a cohesion. It's a physicality. Mm. I think it's very physical music. Mm. But I think there's a complete oneness.
Mm.
It all sounds a bit zen. But really, when the rhythm section or whatever is working together and you're just one, it's divine.
It is, isn't it? Mm.
Yeah. It really is divine. So, and I heard that in the trio. I heard it at McKinley.
Mm.
And in performance.
Mm.
And now and again, I've had that experience.
Oh, you have. I've heard you do it.
It's beautiful.
Yeah.
And it's wonderful. And so, yes.
I'm sure we've all experienced it. I'm not for a moment suggesting that this is, you know, it's me. I think any musician who's got a desire to achieve that outcome, you know, and is prepared to go through the fire in order to get to that place, that person will know
what it feels like. And it usually happens within a combination of people that you play with.
Yeah.
That it's more than just music. It becomes more than music. It's your relationship, really.
It is.
It's playing a lot together.
It is.
That continuity. That's
absolutely.
Everything is playing regularly together.
Everything in music is relational.
Mm.
Yeah.
That's music consists only of relationships between various different elements, which is also true of the universe, right? Mm. Everything in the universe is relational. So, you know, the attempted domination of paradigms of music by this or that force is doomed to failure, ultimately.
Absolutely, it is.
Yeah. Just one, Eugene and Tamara, as a mentor, what was that like?
Well, I think we have really different experiences, but like when I think about, because I grew up, like those Monday nights at Bennett's Lane, I got dragged to a lot of jazz gigs against my will as a kid. And now, the jokes I make, it's now what I do.
She took over.
Yeah. but I remember going to a lot of those gigs on Mondays and just not really, like I was 13 or 14 and I was going to lots of different gigs and I remember seeing some of those gigs on Mondays and just going, what the hell is happening? Like, I was so young and then Al was like talking about ASIO being out the front and I'm like, who's ASIO? I don't know what's happening. And then as I got older, I was like, this is brilliant. Like, you know, you start getting in on some of the jokes and his super dry sense of humour and all the literature and then just the way and the humour and all of the stuff all in there together, so amazing. And so then he put together the trio with Andrea Keller and myself. Mm. And it's not like someone comes up to you and says, I'm going to be your mentor. You just are in this thing and you realise that you're in this relationship with someone who's sharing all this stuff with you. And it's not till really years later, I think, that you start realising what's been happening. Well, for me anyway, that was my experience.
Yeah.
It was so exact. All those things that you were talking about, Paul, where he just has this real liberation of the way he thinks about music and art and how it's just all one big soup in a great way. And I really appreciate that too because he's got such a strong traditional grounding in his musicianship and sort of, you know, journey. So and to have someone who has that and is also, they've got the history but just this great broad approach to music and art and how it's all the same thing. And, you know, some of those gigs, he'd just ask us to do these things which just totally blew my mind. But I was like, yep, great, whatever, like a just complete trust.
Yeah.
And with him and Andrea, of course, I was in such good hands and they were both just so amazing. And so I was very, very lucky to be a very young bass player in that world. And I was talking to someone about some of those gigs the other day, actually, where some, and you do a month or two residency on those Mondays as you're preparing for a recording or something, and you know, not all of them are you feeling great when you walk in. You might be busy or stressed just in your life outside of music, and you're like, oh, I want to do this gig and I think I'm going to be terrible. But every time I would do those gigs, I'd just walk out feeling amazing. Like, I just have a great time, have a great shared experience with Andrea and Alan. That thing where just everything else is suspended when you're in that space. And it was really, really special, I think. Mm. But for me, the big one, I reckon, is just that, yeah, just that broadness about how you can approach music. There's just no limits on what you can do. But also, one thing I love that Al did was he just had this real, like, don't waste any time thing. Like, if he wants to do a project, he'd just start doing a project and just, like, not mess around. And that's something I'm trying to remind myself of all the time.
It's so easy to do the opposite.
Yeah, I know. It's easy to procrastinate. Because
it's facing your fears all the time.
Yeah. But, I mean, I think Huge probably has a very different thing because you were doing lots of traditional stuff with Al when you were younger. Perhaps.
Yeah, I mean, the musical influence, the musical mentorship is really about, for me, was really about the attitude with which you play music, the, you know, the go for it continually or be doomed. and play like it's your last gig, all of that kind of stuff. But the humour as well, you know, like Al singing Body and Soul in German. He did that once at Bennett's, and, you know, he sat down at the bar at the end of the set or whatever, and someone came up to someone with a, you know, a slight woman with an American accent said, okay, great drumming, man, but you know, I really don't dig the singing. And, and it was Betty Carter.
I love the way he always referred to Gary Costello as being in a top secret space program. Yeah, yeah.
And the blue ambulance.
What's the blue ambulance?
That was Howard's Wolseley.
Oh, right.
Where certain things were
substances
in the brakes. And they were both a bit paranoid with the old whatever it was taking. And
I have no idea what they were
and
doing.
And so Alan loved this. He loved to make them even more paranoid. Yeah. He'd announce stuff at Bennett's Lane about, and Bill Howard would say, don't say who I am. Please, just say
Billy,
the trombonist. Don't mention my name.
Because of the listening devices.
Because of the devices. Yeah. I think Gary was a bit paranoid at times, too.
No doubt.
So the blue ambulance...
Statistically, he must have been paranoid at times.
Yes, yeah. Most. Anyway, that was the blue ambulance. And there was a point where Alan couldn't even say Bill was playing the trombone when Bill was on the stand with the trombone. It got less and less. And Alan loved it. He'd laugh and do it all the more, of course.
Well, I mean, that's the other... Seems that's the other part of what I was going to say as well, is playing with Al, you know, I always felt supported in every aspect of life, not just musical life, you know. Mm. He never... And, you know, maybe it's something to do with, you know, the way he dealt with his alcoholism, is that, you know, he made that decision and never went back. But he was always so forgiving and so understanding. There was never a question of judgment about anything that I did or anything that any other musician did, as long as you were, you know, just... Well, as long as nothing.
Turned up on time?
No.
The famous drum instructional video.
Well, you've got to be wearing the right clothes.
Always turn up on time.
The terrific incident at the Victorian Jazz Club when...
Oh, yes.
Chris Tanner and I... At the Victorian Jazz Club is the sort of quite conservative, traditional jazz organisation in Melbourne. And Chris and I... I don't know, I think I would have been about 18, Chris must have been 15. We turned up to gig at the VJC. It was winter, we had long coats on, but we were wearing dresses underneath.
Yeah.
And we, you know, in the middle of the set, we disrobed and revealed our dresses. I don't know why we did that.
Head of your time.
It's just something you did. And Al got a letter from the VJC afterwards that was just furious. And so he penned one back that said, "You're absolutely correct. I was foolish. I'll never hire musicians for the way they play above the way they dress again. Rest assured, they've both been sacked and will never work in this town again." And whoever has that letter, I want it.
It's a great jazz document, that's for sure.
It is. Yeah, it's probably in the archives. Yeah.
When you said your father wanted a jug of Drambuie to play Golden Wedding.
Yes.
I remembered that someone was booking Alan. And part of the brief was that he would play the Golden Wedding. And he said, no.
Right.
And this person said, "Well, you will never work for me again." And Alan said, "Fine." And I won't mention who it was.
Okay.
But the Golden Wedding, that really made me laugh. You reminded me when you talked of that the other day.
Yeah.
So it's fantastic to maintain your integrity.
Well, he was absolutely uncompromising about that. Mm-hmm. There was never a situation where we would not play the way we played, regardless of whether it was appropriate for the actual situation. If we'd been booked to be us, we would be us, even if they'd mistakenly booked us. Well, there was the other incident up at Threadbow one year. I think it was with the Drunken Boat, which is possibly some of the least easy to digest music that I made with the quintet. It's really quite confronting. And because that's a festival that has a traditional component largely and a small contemporary component, I think most of the audience thought that the Alan Brown Quintet was his New Orleans ensemble. So, you know, we went into the gig and it was just packed. And we thought, this is going to be terrific. It's going to be, nothing like a gig on Monday at Bennett's. Not that they weren't terrific. And, you know, sure enough, we started to play the Drunken Boat, and within about 10 minutes, the place was empty, except for two musicians from Sydney. Yeah. And that was, you know, that was a success in Al's book. Raging success.
I do remember playing a wedding with him and our guest Gary. There must have been some other people in the band. And it was at what is now called the World Trade Center, I think, down on
South Wharf.
South Wharf, yeah. Or whatever it is,
yeah.
And it was a strange wedding. But I do remember that we were playing the Bridal Waltz, and it was that tune, that sort of old Russian song, which, you know, is sometimes called "Oh, How We Danced on the Night We Were Wed," right? And for reasons which now elude me, I couldn't stop playing the song. It just went around and around and around and around and around.
Did you go
and around
to the
maybe.
Blue Hospital?
Something happened. Something happened. I don't remember what. But and as I recall it, Alan just lost it. He just thought it was the most hilarious thing he'd ever seen. It was the space program in action, in full flight. I think we played for like 45 minutes.
Oh, gee.
Yeah, it was, you know, like Coltrane live in Seattle.
Oh, that's hilarious.
But really, really boring. Yeah.
But Alan had interesting ideas, and I don't know whether he ever talked to you about it, but he was convinced that Bennett's Lane was a reincarnation of Café Tortoni in Paris. And he did a lot of research and brought me books to try and convince me that Bennett's Lane was this reincarnation.
Oh, no, he'd never mentioned that to me.
Yeah, I've got the books.
Yep.
I try and show my kids. That's wow. What Ben and Slane was, reincarnation. But Cafe Tortoni was like this famous cafe that writers, artists, painters, musicians went to for more than 100 years, more than a century. And it was a popular meeting place. And Alan was convinced that that's what Ben and Slane was. And he kind of convinced me that as well. And
it's a good story.
It is a good story.
Yeah. I'd milk it.
I was going to ask, well, I'd like to ask Tam and Paul, because I am curious about this. Beyond the kind of the charisma and the human that Al was, playing with Al from a rhythm section perspective, what was it that, you know, was so special about that? I have my own relationship with his playing from a trumpet perspective, and I've got to say, sometimes on stage things did feel a little bit lumpy, but whenever I heard Al playing, it was just so smooth from, you know, from off stage. So, I don't know, I just wondered if you could articulate what it was about his drumming that was so engaging.
I mean, for me, his swing feel is just, like, awesome. His, like, ride sound and swing feel, like, all of that is just super fun. But it's interesting, and we've spoken about this before, because being a bass player, you end up filling in with other people's bands too, and I'd done some filling in with the quintet as well.
That's right.
But most of the playing I'd done with him was with Andrea in that trio. And it was really interesting the way he played with me and Andy versus the quintet was actually quite different. And it was something that I didn't realise until, because I've been playing with the trio for a number of years and then was doing some quintet gigs when... I guess it was, I don't know, is it Nick normally who does the quintet? So when I guess he was away or couldn't do it, I was filling in a bit. And I was like, wow, this is really, it's sort of a different Al. And with me and Andrea, I felt like he listened maybe a bit more. And I think he was a bit more sensitive or something. And I don't know whether, why that was, but I just thought it was really interesting. And then with the quintet, the sort of younger guys, and he'd sort of play just much more aggressively and a lot louder. And it was just really interesting. Not that he wasn't loud and fiery with me and Andy as well, but it was just a really different, just a different sensibility or something that he, I think he approached those ensembles with, you know. But for me, it was just the swing thing was just so awesome. Like once you start playing with him, and I feel like the same thing that you were saying before, that I could just do anything and totally be myself. And if I'm hearing something that maybe is a bit different to what I'd normally do, I could totally just try it out and it's going to be fine. And with him and Andrea too, that was just so easy. Whereas I remember playing with the quintet and I just felt like I had to like be much more like a head down and charge sort of approach, just because that was stylistically what happened in that group a bit
more. Well, I think that music terrified him a bit too, the quintet music. Like it was more complex than a lot of music he played, so I think he had to kind of put the blinkers on and just like, you know, commit to his part as he imagined it. Yeah.
With the trio, I mean, the whole thing about the trio was that nobody had to play a role. It was like everybody was free to improvise completely at all times, irrespective of what we were playing.
Sounds fun.
So everything we were playing was around structures of various kinds. So most of the music we played was, I'd say the majority of it was written by me, but we played, you know, standards and stuff too. But Gary played very freely around, you know, swooping. As I have described his bass lines, they swoop. You know, you don't often describe a bass player swooping, but he's like some sort of sub-aquatic bird. And I'd be doing my thing, and Alan was in the middle. So Alan, what he had was extraordinarily accurate and consistent time. And within which he would do his own, you know, infinite variations. But it was always very clear what he was doing. Because he used to think mainly, he'd be very cognizant of the phrase lengths of pieces that we were playing. Mm. So if we had a 7-bar phrase followed by, and this, a lot of my music was like this, 7-bar phrase, 9-bar phrase, you know, 3-bar phrase, he would really articulate those things.
Yep.
So there was always very good signposting.
Yeah.
But it really did enable us to play very, very freely and communicatively mm-hmm. as a band. And, you know, you don't get that often. I mean, it was a lot of it was located in how he had learned to play the drums. So he wasn't this kind of, you know, technical, chops-oriented, look at me, look at me, look at me sort of drummer. He was, you know, using the very compacted rudiments that he had worked very hard on, mm-hmm. But managed to create a language by using all of those rudiments like a Rubik's cube, like a puzzle, and putting them all together in different configurations.
A really idiosyncratic language.
Yeah,
as
absolutely.
Well,
right? There's no it's drummer that sounds like him.
Wow. Yeah.
If there was one I used to compare him to in my mind, it was Roy Haynes.
Mm-hmm. Really?
Hmm. He reminded me of Roy Haynes in certain
That's
ways.
Interesting. I made a list of all the drummers that he always talked about because I won't remember because it's, you know how you forget names?
Mm.
Anyway, but he loved Art Blakey and I've got a whole list of them here. I'll just tell you. And he talked about these people all the time. So Tony Williams and Max Roach and mm-hmm. Art Blakey and Elvin and Philly Joe and what I noticed with listening to those as he would play things, favourite things, that there was a sort of, you know how they can measure the pulse of a song with the human heartbeat?
Mm.
It sits in a certain space, the tempo, that I found Alan had perfect, and they did too. It's calling a tempo and it's a heartbeat and it's just perfect. If you were to measure it on a metronome, which you don't want to do, but it was sitting perfectly, perfectly, and it locked, and it stayed there.
Mm-hmm.
It never moved.
Mm.
And it was like this divine structure that was the underlying armchair with Alan.
Yep.
Mm.
And then, of course, there was his beautiful accents, his tastefulness. His whole attitude was, we are listening to each other. This is a conversation. We are listening very carefully to what's being said. And we don't speak until we solo. The rest of the time, this is a cohesive, supportive unit, which is what you're talking about in the trio and what I've heard Eugene speak of and Tamara. And it's so important. It's a philosophical, artistic understanding that you don't learn, particularly by just being academic. I think it's something else, which he was happy to say he was an autodidact. So, there's something in that.
And those perfect tempos, you know, that he... When I started playing with his New Orleans band, the Rascals, I was probably 17, maybe 18, and he wouldn't let me count the tempos when I joined. He always counted the tempos. Then after a couple of years, he sort of said, you know, every tempo has to be comfortably divisible either into 16ths or triplet quavers. And if it sits in the cracks of either of those two things, then I can't play that tempo. So once he'd kind of, you know, lectured me about that many times and demonstrated, you know, very clearly how to do it, he let me take charge of the tempos. And I still often think about that with regard to tempos. It's a good system.
Yeah.
We've only got about 5 minutes left of this session, so if there's any other questions or things before we wrap up, now is the time to ask. Or...
Hush now. It's been very nice to do this.
Yeah. Mm. Well, we might wrap things up then if we're all finished and there's nothing else to say.
Dim.
Yes, please.
Just thinking of the considering the legacy and influence over multiple generations, ingredients that we need to consciously support so the next generations maybe comes to the forefront?
I missed the last bit of it, Tim. What was the...
What are the ingredients that we need to ensure that AV's spirit lives on in more people, in more structures that are supported by, you know, fantastic patrons with regular gigs, those sorts of things? How do we keep that mentorship going in our scene so that the next generation can tell the stories?
I think Andrea Keller is doing a great job at continuing that legacy. Obviously very different, but she is amazing. You know, her output, her creativity, her involvement. I don't know how she does it all, like, to be honest, but she runs the Monday nights at the Jazz Lab in the same tradition.
Mm.
And, you know, I'm astounded by her ability. And that's very healthy for the scene and, you know, the new generation of players.
I absolutely agree with that.
One thing I probably would add to that too is that it's something that I didn't realise that was maybe a bit unusual that Al has done in Melbourne, but just the way he's just integrated all the different generations of musicians in this town is, I feel like it's fairly unique. I don't know if there's many other cities. I just thought that was a normal thing because that's how I grew up here and that's how I knew things were, and just the way Al would always be hiring young, like when Shannon Barnett was quite young, putting her in a trio like without bass and just piano and drums, like that's just amazing. So innovative and interesting, and having that run for ages and sort of developing those mentorships and just breaking down those barriers about who can hire who. And I don't think it was anything that was explicitly said, but it was demonstrated for, like, how many years was that residency? Like,
Ben Slane?
Yeah.
Well, but as long as I remember, you know, not long after I opened, Alan was there on Monday nights and...
Yeah.
And
so we're talking decades, right? How long was Bennett's there?
92 till, until 2015, so the whole time.
Yeah.
But, you know, that's huge. So for me, like, that's something I think that's just part of Melbourne now, and I feel like Al was largely responsible for that.
Yeah. I would just say that, you know, a person like Alan comes around once every few generations. It's you know, we're very lucky to have experienced what he has done.
Mm.
Mm. He has really created, I think, the bedrock of jazz and approaches to that word and beyond that word to wider concepts of improvised music in this city. And, you know, don't expect that it's going to happen, that another Alan Brown is waiting around the corner, because it's highly unlikely. But it may happen. That's the thing. There might be another person who's going to come along and be a game changer like Alan. But at the moment, we are lucky to have the examples that he has set and try and live up to those examples, like Andrea, but also in the way we go about making our music. There are many principles in what he embodied that are absolutely, you know, should be the heart and soul of what we do and the approach that we take. And that's what we can communicate to people who are coming after us. There are principles, and they are quite easily laid out, actually. But a lot of them have got to do with life itself.
Mm. And even though, you know, Al's mentorship was, as Tam, as you pointed out, like, totally informal, I think there should be, you know, elements of Al's teachings embedded in, you know, university curricula. I would certainly like to see that.
He might have used Duncan Bagels on the piano to help someone play the drums, like Raj. He'd always say, play along with me as I do Duncan Bagels. singing really badly. You know that crazy guy?
Yes.
Was it Slim Gaylard?
When did you say he did that when he was teaching Raj?
Yes, yes. When he was teaching any drummers.
Oh, that's funny.
He'd play that and say, "Now you play along with me, Dunkin' Bagels, splash in the coffee." Okay, so you're going to integrate that into sort of academic institutions?
Yeah, well, yes, absolutely.
Yeah,
it'd make
agree,
the institution
Paul.
Far more enjoyable places, I can tell you.
Well, that seems like an excellent point to finish today on.
I want donuts and bagels and things.
Can you please thank our speakers today, Eugene Ball, Paul Grabowski, Marguerite Dyer and Michael Chautain.
Tam.
We'd like to thank the Melbourne International Jazz Festival and the Melbourne Recital Centre for having us today. Thanks so much.
That was Salute to Alan Brown, recorded at Melbourne International Jazz Festival Congress. Please keep in touch with Melbourne International Jazz Festival by subscribing to our e-news at melbournejazz.com. Follow us on social media and subscribe on your preferred platform for more podcast episodes. We would like to thank Principal Partners Creative Victoria and the Australia Council, the Vizard Foundation, the Rise Fund, an Australian Government Initiative, the Helen McPherson Smith Trust, and the US Consulate.